The East River dockyard smelled of rotting fish and coal smoke, the kind of morning that made you question every life choice that led to wearing leather boots instead of rubber ones. Pearl Casey stood at the edge of Pier 43, her breath pluming in the damp air, and tried not to look at the body bag zipped halfway up. Michael Doyle had already called it a drowning. He'd said it with that particular combination of certainty and exhaustion that came from handling too many suicides and too few murders. The coroner would confirm it by noon. There would be paperwork filed, a name entered into a ledger, and the river would take another man and pretend it never happened. Pearl didn't believe in pretenses. "You shouldn't be here, Pearl." Doyle leaned against a stack of shipping crates, his hat pulled low over gray eyes that had seen too many bodies float past without recognition when he had taught. "This isn't your case. It's not even our precinct." He had pressed his lips together. "It's my case now." She kept her voice level. The trick to being taken seriously in a room full of men who thought women belonged in secretarial pools was to speak as though the matter was already settled and they were the ones catching up. Doyle sighed, the sound like gravel shifting under a boot heel. "Coroner says lungs full of river water, no marks on the neck, no signs of struggle. He walked in, he drowned, we pull him out. End of story." "The hem is stitched." That got his attention. Doyle straightened. "What?" "The dead man's trousers. The bottom of the right leg closed with thread and needle, not a factory seam. Hand-stitched. I counted 6 stitches before the fabric ended." Pearl crouched beside the body bag, ignoring the cold seeping through her knees into the damp wood of the pier. "Who hand-stitches the hem of a dead man's trousers?" "Doyle," the coroner approached, wiping his hands on a rag that had once been white. His name was Silas, and he wore it like a badge of honor, crisp, professional, slightly arrogant. "You want to tell me what you think that means, Miss Casey? Because I'm about to write up a report, and I'd prefer it contain facts rather than speculation." Pearl rose slowly. "The fact is his hem was closed by hand after he was dressed, or after he died. Hard to say without cutting the fabric." Harlan's jaw tightened. "You're not authorized to cut anything on a NYPD-processed corpse." "I'm not asking to cut anything. I'm noting that the stitching exists." She reached into her coat pocket and withdrew a small notebook, the leather cover cracked from years of use. She flipped to a fresh page and began sketching the shape of the man's lower leg, the placement of the stitches, the way the thread caught the dim light differently than the factory weave around it. "Can you tell me his name?" Harlan exchanged a glance with Doyle. "Victim, machinist, Cooper Union Workshop, 23rd District. Lives in a room above a bakery on the Bowery. Married, 2 children, youngest 4 years old." He paused. "He was last seen leaving the factory gates at 5 o'clock yesterday evening. No one has seen him since." "Doyle said he walked into the river." "Doyle said what I told him to say." Doyle's voice carried an edge now, the weary gravel turning sharp. "Pearl, go home, take the day off. Something for the children, maybe. Ice cream, a parade." She ignored him. "Where's the body now?" "Temporary morgue, Draper Street, room 3. Harlan checked his pocket watch, a gold-cased thing that probably cost more than Pearl's annual salary. "I'll have it moved to the main facility by afternoon. You'll have until then if you want to look."
"I want to look now."
Harlan hesitated, then nodded toward a pair of warehouse hands loitering near a flatbed cart. "Boys, take her to Draper Street." The walk to Draper Street took 20 minutes through streets that smelled of wet wool and horse manure. Pearl kept her collar turned up against the drizzle and her mind clear. She had learned early that thinking clearly was harder than thinking at all. Most people let their thoughts run like dogs off leash, chasing every scent, barking at every shadow. Pearl kept hers on a short lead. Room 3 of the temporary morgue was a converted storage closet, barely large enough for the metal table where Thomas Erickson lay exposed from the waist up. Water damage had begun already, the skin pale and bloated, the fingers pruned like an old man's after a bath. Pearl noted the discoloration around the mouth, blue-gray, the color of tarnished silver. Not the pinkish foam you expected from drowning. Something else had been in those lungs. Not in a police file, not in a textbook, in her father's workshop 30 years ago when he taught her to mend clothes instead of throwing them away. He'd pressed the needle through with his knuckle, showing her how the tension should sit not too tight to pucker the fabric, not too loose to gap under strain.
"Sinew for heavy wool," he'd muttered, pulling the thread taut until it sang. "Cotton'll snap. Silk'll rot. Sinew lasts." 6 stitches, dark thread, thick enough to hold fabric under strain, tied off at both ends with knots that were almost but not quite symmetrical. Amateur work. Someone had tried to be careful and failed. The thread caught the overhead light differently than the cotton weave around it, darker, almost black against the faded gray wool. Pearl traced the line of the stitching with her thumb, feeling the slight ridge where the thread had pulled the fabric tight. Her pulse quickened, not from fear, from recognition. She'd seen this kind of stitching before. Not recorded in any official docket, nor found within the pages of any academic tome. Instead, it lived in her father's workshop, 30 years prior, when he had instructed her to mend garments rather than discard them. "A good stitch holds," he would say, his hands rough and capable even at 50. "A bad stitch holds until it doesn't, then everything falls apart." She examined the knots more closely. The thread wasn't cotton or linen, it was sinew, animal fiber, the kind used for heavy-duty work in factories and shipyards. And the knot at the bottom end was a double loop, the kind sailors used to secure cargo. Someone had sewn something into that hem. Something small enough to fit inside the folded fabric, but substantial enough to require 6 stitches to seal it shut. Pearl pulled a pair of scissors from her coat pocket, small, sharp, the kind seamstresses used for precise cuts, and positioned the blade beneath the middle stitch. "Miss Casey," Doyle's voice came from the doorway. He hadn't followed her in. He stood at the threshold, arms crossed, expression unreadable. "If you cut that thread, you're tampering with evidence. I can have you arrested before lunch. If I don't cut that thread, I'm letting a man die twice." She didn't look up. The blade slipped beneath the sinew thread with a soft snick. Once by whatever killed him, once by whatever killed him after. The thread parted with a sound like a sigh. Pearl unfolded the hem carefully, working the fabric loose stitch by stitch. Inside the fold, wrapped in a square of wax paper no larger than her thumbnail, was a key. Brass, worn at the teeth. The bow shaped like a small gear with 7 teeth, each one filed to a different height. Not a house key. Not a car key. There were no cars in 1897 anyway. A lock that belonged to something mechanical, something important. Pearl held it up to the light. The brass gleamed dully, the metal darkened by years of handling. She turned it over. On the flat surface of the bow, barely visible, someone had engraved 2 letters, SV. Selah's Vane. The name hit her like a punch to the stomach. Vane owned 3 factories along the East River. Vane controlled half the elevated railway contracts in Manhattan. Vane was the kind of man who didn't leave things to chance. He built machines that made chance obsolete. And now, he had a key hidden inside the hem of a dead machinist's trousers. "Doyle," she said quietly, "I need to take this." "No. I need to examine it. I need to find out what lock it opens." "Pearl," Doyle's voice dropped to that gravelly register that meant he was trying very hard not to raise it. "That is evidence. It stays here. It goes into a property bag. It gets logged. You get a receipt. You do not pocket evidence from a corpse." She looked at the key in her palm, then at Doyle's face. He was right, technically, but technical correctness had never saved anyone from being killed twice. She slid the key into her coat pocket. The brass pressed cold against her ribs. "What did you find?" Harlan asked from behind them, having apparently decided to stay and watch the drama unfold. Pearl met his gaze evenly. "The hem was hand-stitched, nothing more. I haven't cut anything." "I haven't touched anything." She let the lie sit in the air between them like smoke. "It was already open when I got here." Doyle's eyes narrowed. He knew she was lying. He also knew he couldn't prove it without dragging a woman into a station house over a piece of thread on a dead man's trousers. He made a decision Pearl recognized instantly, the same decision he made every time bureaucracy got in the way of justice. He swallowed it. "Fine," he said, "but you're done here. Go home, Pearl, take the day." She nodded, turned, and walked out of room 3 with the key burning a hole in her pocket, and Thomas Erickson's blue-gray mouth still frozen in whatever expression he'd worn when he realized he wasn't going to make it out of the river alive. On the street, the rain had worsened. Pearl pulled her collar higher and walked west, her mind racing faster than her feet. Esvi, Selah's Vane,
The key was Vane's, but why was it sewn into Erickson's hem? A machinist from Cooper Union, 23rd District. Last seen leaving the factory gates at 5 o'clock. Something had happened between 5 and when Erickson ended up in the river. Something that required him to hide a key inside his own clothing, or something that required someone else to sew it there after he was already dead. Pearl stopped at a crosswalk and watched a streetcar clatter past, its bells ringing frantically in the damp air. A newsboy shouted headlines she couldn't hear over the rain. River claims another police rule accident. She pulled the key from her pocket again. The brass was warm now, heated by her body heat, the engraved letters SV catching the gray light. 7 teeth filed to different heights. A gear-shaped bow. This wasn't just any lock. This was precision work. The kind of lock that belonged to a machine, or a vault, or a private office. Pearl closed her fist around the key and started walking. She needed to find out what lock this opened. She needed to find out why Thomas Erickson was dead. And she needed to do it before whoever killed him realized that the key was missing. The rain fell harder. Pearl didn't slow down. Behind her, across the street, a man in a gray coat watched from the shelter of an awning. He didn't move. He didn't speak. He simply waited, his hands deep in his pockets, his eyes fixed on Pearl's retreating figure like a hawk tracking prey through tall grass. Pearl didn't notice him. She never did not until it was too late. She was too busy thinking about the 6 stitches, the sinew thread, and the 2 letters engraved in brass. SV. Selah's Vane was a man who didn't leave things to chance. But Thomas Erickson had left this. He'd hidden the key in his own clothing, hoping that someone would find it. Someone sharp enough to notice the stitches. Someone stubborn enough to cut them. Pearl quickened her pace. The key pressed against her ribs like a second heartbeat. Whatever Erickson had discovered, whatever he'd tried to protect, it was bigger than a drowning. It was bigger than a machinist from the 23rd District. It was bigger than Pearl herself. And she was already in too deep to turn back. The streetcar bells rang again. Somewhere ahead, a factory whistle blew, its mournful cry carrying over the rooftops like a prayer. Pearl Casey kept walking, the key in her pocket, the rain on her face, and the terrible certainty that Thomas Erickson hadn't drowned at all. He'd been thrown. And whoever had done it knew exactly who would find the key. Which meant they knew exactly who she was. Which meant she was no longer investigating a death. She was surviving one. She turned her collar up against the damp chill and walked away, the weight of the brass key grounding her steps on the cobblestones.